One of the Buddhist teachings that confuses a lot of people, perplexes people, is that of anatta, not self, or sometimes said to be no self. And I suspect that it's, if you're one of those people who are confused by these teachings, at least the way it's presented often here in the West by Buddhist teachers, that's a good sign that you're confused. Congratulate yourself. Because I think, in fact, it's often presented. Though the way it's presented has, you know, it might be clear in some certain sense, but I think there's a kind of confusion. And a very simple confusion around it that I can point to is the question of how important it is in the teachings of the Buddha. Kind of growing up in Buddhism, I had the impression that this was like one of the central teachings of the Buddha. And if you wanted to really kind of teach what the Buddha had to teach, you would kind of pretty quickly get to this no-self thing. So in recent years, I spend, you know, some of my discretionary time studying the suttas, studying these ancient texts, and writing about them. And the impression I get is this was not a particularly important teaching for the Buddha. It's there, for sure, in a certain way, but it doesn't strike me as being something like the thing that he most wanted to get people to understand. There is no self. And one of the ways of understanding this is that this teaching of not-self, anatta, is not really inherently important in the Dharma, because it's really a teaching that is countering or correcting for the views of other people, those people who believed in an atta, whatever that is. So, you know, by in and of itself, the Buddhist teachings can be presented quite well without having to talk about this not-self thing. But because in ancient India there were all these people going around talking about atta, he then sometimes addressed this issue. So, I think it's a valuable teaching in certain ways. But what's happened here in the modern West is that we have translated the word atta as self and anatta as not self or no self. And if you give me a little bit of permission to say, you know, bold statement that maybe is meant to be a little bit provocative, but maybe not definitive, like this is the truth. But I think if you look at how Western discourse and psychology and studies of consciousness and, I don't know, philosophy, and you start studying what they have to say, what the self is, I think as a culture we're confused. Some people think they know this is what it is. But, you know, I think Matthew's done a lot of study in this regard, right, Matthew? You know some of the literature, right?
Yeah.
You're not confused. You know what it is. So maybe tomorrow you'll get your chance to. So, you know, we start saying no self, no self, then people get confused and like, well, how, what here? You know, if there's no self, then do I scratch someone else's itch? You know, whose itch is it? It's very, you know, very confusing, I think. So here's an example. So this is a woman named Joy Manet. She was a wonderful Buddhist scholar until she decided that Buddhist scholarship was not as interesting as meditation. And then she became a meditation teacher. But in the time that she was a scholar, she studied early Buddhist, the Pali Suttas, wonderful work. And she wrote this. At a recent conference, whose theme was The Psychology of Awakening, Buddhism, Science, and Psychotherapy, many of the participants expressed their confusion regarding how the Buddha could function in the world without a self. Because they were Buddhists, they were trying to follow the teaching and to achieve, or to imitate, what they imagined this form of functioning could be, that is, functioning as a no-self. Well, I thought they had missed the point. What the texts show, the ancient suttas, what the texts show in the character of the Buddha is someone with a very advanced self-concept. His self-esteem is perfect. He has gone beyond doubt. He knows. He is confident of his knowledge. He expresses himself with conviction. When the Buddha talks of himself in the first person, he does so with clarity. He has a strong sense of identity and knows very well who he is. He gives accounts of his life experiences in the first person. He gives accounts of his spiritual capacities in the first person. For example, he announces and proclaims that he is a Buddha, and he says what a Buddha is. He gives first-person accounts of the capacities required of him by society. For example, he insists he is a competent debater. He discusses at ease and in full equality with kings and other notables. He defends himself and his teaching against unjust accusations and false representations. It is clear that the Buddha's, quote, self, as this concept is understood in contemporary psychology and psychotherapy, namely a clear sense of identity, the ability to function competently and realistically in the world, to have a standard of ethics, to achieve one's goals, to interact with people, to make good choices, and so forth, was fully functional and remarkably well developed, as one would expect. Neither psychotherapy nor meditation is possible unless the sense of identity or ego is mature and well-grounded. Otherwise, there is nothing to change and nothing to go beyond. So that's a confident statement by Joy Manet about the Buddha. So one of the themes for this retreat is that there are three insights that are the byproduct of doing the three cultivations. And that what we're doing in practice is we're cultivating certain states. So we're cultivating stability. And there's other words, other concepts that come along under the concept of stability. And concentration practice is a stabilizing practice. So the degree to which we develop concentration, either directly through concentration practice or through mindfulness practice, we're developing stability, calm, steadiness, ability to focus. And those are abilities that can grow and develop over time, both as a skill or a muscle which gets stronger, and maybe, but also very importantly, as a consequence of letting go. A lot of concentration comes from not from doing, but comes from letting go. So it's almost like an undoing, a non-doing, settling back into a kind of settled, natural state of being unfragmented, undistracted. So, and then there's the cultivation of well-being. And it's remarkable when the Buddha talked about the various stages along the path of to liberation, every stage of practice is described as resulting in some form of well-being or happiness. Matthew talked about the bliss of blamelessness. There's also other kinds of blisses and joys and happiness and gladness that comes along with the practice. And so, you know, in a sense, you know, we're cultivating well-being, and that's what we're looking for. Not just to be happy, because that can be egotistical, or that can be as the only goal can be kind of shortchanging oneself. But for the Buddha, the happy mind created a really good foundation to have liberating insights, to have these insights. And I remember, you know, that one of the times when I was practicing on retreat, where I had a really kind of a dramatic and sudden experience, or understanding, I guess maybe more than experience, understanding of how pervasive suffering is in this world in a way that I kind of never really understood before. It was like pretty, I stopped in my tracks. I was like, wow, that's a lot. And, you know, on one hand, it could be quite depressing to have that. But I had so much joy in my practice during that time that the joy held that insight. It kind of kept me afloat, or buoyed the insight, so that I could have this insight and it could affect me. I could be changed by it in wise, good ways. But it didn't weigh me down, because it was held up by the joy, or contained by the joy, or something like that. And so then the insight into not self, which we'll talk about in a few days, but when we don't cultivate that, there's wonderfully maybe sad stories of Dharma practitioners who are trying to enact not having a self. And I think them, you know, they won't use the first person pronoun. You know, and you say, how are you feeling? And they say, well, there's a lot of energy swirling around in the chest, and there's heat, and there's, you know, and you look at them and say, but how are you feeling? Oh, you know, impermanent phenomena coming and going. And you say, but you sure look angry. You know, so, you know, so there's kind of sometimes an unwillingness even to admit what people are feeling. And then there's the people I've known, you know, I've known a whole series of people who have tried to be this non-self thing, and it's mostly an irritant. You know, one of the forms is like going to restaurants to have, you know, and we're going to order food, and then what would you like? You know, what restaurant would you, what kind of restaurant would you like to go to? Oh, whatever you want. Whatever you want. You know, it's like, you know, kind of an unwillingness to step up and have the burden has to be on us to have to make the decisions. I mean, help out sometimes. Don't just always be kind of this, you know, this nothing. But the insight can be, people have there are some very deep and meaningful insights into not self, but it comes from cultivating the opposite, or the opposite supports it. Exactly what we call the opposite, maybe you have your own words you prefer. I like the word confidence, and sometimes I'll say self-confidence, but I'm a little bit shy to use the self thing, because maybe I got that virus too. You know, it was contagious. But Joy Manias doesn't seem to shy away from the word self in her, her description here. But I like the word confidence, and one of the functions of meditation practice is to bring about a certain kind of inner confidence, a certain inner strength, a certain kind of an ability to self-monitor oneself, to monitor what goes on here, really know what one likes and doesn't like, what one believes, what one doesn't believe, what one feels, what motivated by, what one's reactions are, to really kind of monitor this and be really clear, and not to be, you know, to have only vague understanding of what our operating system is, but to have a lot of clarity that what's going on inside, and be able to convey that and function the world with that. Self-understanding. A sense of efficacy, a sense that one can engage, one can do, one can, you know, that can accomplish certain things. You know, I have the ability to engage and do something. And I know for me that from doing this Vipassana practice for a long time, I have a lot of confidence. And I don't exactly say it's self-confidence, but it could be seen that way. But I have a lot of confidence, certainly in the practice, but, you know, that I can do it, usually, enough of the time. And then I have to apply myself, and it doesn't come automatically. I just sit down and, you know, I can do it perfectly. But if I give myself over to it and apply myself to it, that it gets the Vipassana practice, the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and more clear and more penetrating into my experience. So I have some confidence that this is something I can do. And that confidence, you know, buoys me, supports me, and I feel like I carry it with me through my world, that I have certain confidences that make it easier to navigate the world and be in the world, and being mindful is a big part of that. So part of practice is to develop, you know, self-confidence or confidence or a sense of strength. And I think this goes along with the idea that, if you go back to the suttas, it seems to me that the Buddha has a lot of valuing and respect for individual people. He's not, you know, it's a, he looks upon people with respectful eyes, with caring eyes, with maybe even with, I don't know if it's a, maybe it's a modern word concept, but the idea of each individual person with dignity, and with a person's dignity and their autonomy. The word, wonderful word, autonomy. I was asked to be on a hospital ethics committee, and they were explaining to me some of the ethical principles that the hospital operates on, and I guess that guides them in their, that ethics committee and what they do. And one of the principles that they operate under is the idea of autonomy, that each individual person has autonomy, and that guides them in understanding how to take care of a patient. And so one of the beautiful stories that I like, that kind of conveys the sense of the Buddha viewing people with value, dignity, worth, or something, is him telling a simile of the path of practice that he discovered, you know, the Eightfold Path, leading to liberation. And he said that it was like a person who goes into the woods, maybe works in the woods, goes into the woods and travels around in the jungle, and then one day discovers a small little clue or evidence that there used to be a road in there, paved road. So the person clears a little bit more of the debris and the vegetation, say, yeah, in fact, there's a beautiful big road. And then begins following the road deeper and deeper into the forest. And the end of the road finds there's this big city or ancient capital or palace that, you know, is just waiting to be inhabited again. Kind of maybe like they find these whole cities and pyramids in Yucatan, the Mayas. And then the person comes out and goes to the monarchs of the realm and says to the monarchs, there's this ancient road, and if you follow it, it'll take you to this great capital and palace, and we can inhabit this great place. And so the monarch clears it all up, and they take residence, and everyone's happy ever after. And so in this story, then, the Buddha is the one who, he doesn't claim he makes up the path of practice, but he discovers an ancient path, that's the language, that there's just little trace, just enough traces left that he was able to find. And then he comes back and tells the monarchs of the realm, well, that's us. That's all the people he's teaching, that he's coming back, you know, that's who the monarch is, the simile. And this idea of treating everyone with that kind of respect or that kind of dignity, at least for me, is, you know, very meaningful, kind of, it's a very positive view of human beings. At the same time, the Buddha considered conceit to be a big hindrance. And it's also considered to be one of the more difficult hindrances or attachments to overcome, arrogance and conceit. And it's a real, that's kind of a disease for people. It's a lot of suffering that comes from it. And so how to cultivate this strong confidence, strong sense of self, at the same time dropping conceit, dropping arrogance, is part of the, you know, part of the task here. But not being conceited is not the same thing as understanding not self. You know, people have no idea about Buddhism and liberation, can tune into someone who's conceited and feel the tension of that, the difficulty of that. And in some of these forms of conceit that the Buddha talked about is the conceit of possessiveness, this is mine, or the conceit of identity. There's a variety of identities people take on in a kind of arrogant or attached kind of way. The conceit of possessiveness sometimes can be seen in a meditation center where someone comes and claims a seat for the course of the retreat. And maybe they spend the whole retreat sitting on it, it's fine, and they leave, and they come back a few years later to the retreat center, and they don't remember where they sat, I mean, that was their seat. But during the course of the retreat, it's their seat. That's fine, it's innocent, until you come back after lunch and someone's sitting in it. My seat. They took my seat. And it's all kinds of wonderful qualities of self-righteousness and feeling hurt, all kinds of things can arise. Is it really our seat? It's a seat. And it's, so exactly, it's a little complicated, all the possible and appropriate reactions to that, but the reactions can be a lot stronger if there's conceit involved and, you know, my thing. And then there's the conceit of being a good meditator. That's a real headache for oneself, fellow meditators, and for these poor teachers. Being a good I'm a good meditator, and you know, we should probably be passing out stripes for your sleeves, you know, for the, you know, different levels of attainment and being a good meditator. And you can, and what I've noticed of people who seem to mature in this practice, they seem, overall, they seem less and less interested in using any kind of level of attainment, any level of meditation, as a way of defining themselves, of asserting themselves, like, look at me, this is who I am, or even wanting to know and put themselves on the map. Am I there? Have I arrived yet? Is that, where am I on the map? And after a while, it just doesn't seem so interesting to do that. So to sit upright is also a kind of considered to be a metaphor. Some people have to lay down, which is fine. But we say in English to be upright. I think in proper English, it's upright is to be dignified or honest and be have integrity and be able to appear in the world with some degree of confidence and poise. So we sit upright and we take our seat. There's a teaching in Buddhism about the Bodhi-manda. Bodhi is awakening, and manda is means the seat. So Bodhi-manda is the seat of awakening. When the night that the Buddha became awakened, he sat down on his Bodhi-manda, and he sat there until he was awakened. And when this teaching is usually given and these days, the people make the point that each of us have our Bodhi-manda. It's where you're sitting. On this retreat, you have your Bodhi-manda, until someone else sits in there and finds another one. And so the Bodhi, this is your place of awakening. So how do you sit there if this is your place? You know, it's like you inhabit it, you show up, you're allowed to sit upright. You're allowed to be someone of a valued person like everyone else. You're allowed to exist. You're allowed to take up space. You don't need to be apologize for yourself. I don't know if it's changed in my adult years, because I don't remember this being an issue, but I only noticed it when it started being some articles around it. The number of people who apologize, I'm sorry. I've had people tell me that. Just that, you know, being apologizing for oneself. I mean, there's a time and place to do that for sure, but. So I'll tell you a story. So, you know, I had this Zen background. I practiced Zen for a long time. And at some point in my time as a Zen priest, I got into the time when one of my teachers, Mel Weitzman, wanted to talk to me about becoming a Zen teacher. And the way to do that was to do something called getting a Dharma transmission, a kind of ceremony of empowerment or something. And we were going for a walk around San Francisco, having a talk. And so he asked me about what was my relationship to some of the different teachers at Zen Center, so senior teachers, people who've been my teachers. And what do you think of that person? What do you think of that, you know? So it was just one other person and himself. And I said, well, for the other person, I said, well, I really value that person's dharma and teaching, but I don't really trust the person. But for you, I said, I really trust you as a person, but I'm not always so sure about your dharma. So that's quite something to say. So he just stopped in the sidewalk. So he got in front of me, stopped, and we both stopped, and he looked at me with such, you know, kind of happy and engaged, and he was really there. Boy, he was like fully there for me. And he looked at me and he said, and he put his hands together, you know, kind of in the gassho, but I think it was more like just the gesture of bringing them together. And he said, well, and that's where we'll meet. Wow. You know, rather than being mush and kind of blending together and all becoming one and kind of, in, you know, we're all, there's no self and we're all just kind of, a mush. We were two individual people. And he acknowledged the difference. Something for him, which is probably very deep, very personal. You know, he's a Dharma teacher, you know. It's like his Dharma was saying, I'm not so sure about it. And he just delighted in the chance to be able to meet in that place where there was a difference. So, you know, I was allowed to exist as I was and meet. So, you know, you were allowed to be upright. We're allowed to exist. And then we have to find our way with that. And if there is conceit, and there's a lot of it, it doesn't mean we have to stop being upright. It doesn't mean we have to kind of cave in or shrink away. Or this anatta teaching is not meant to be something that we just kind of like become, you know, like we become, you know, unimportant and just shrink away into the corners because we're not supposed to have a self and be anyone for anyone. That's why I like Joy Moyne's passage here. The Buddha has a lot of confidence. He knows who he is. He presents himself clearly. He engages with other people in a confident way. So to cultivate confidence or a sense of strength in the uprightness of being is really helpful because it does happen as we go into the practice deeper and deeper that a lot of the concepts and ideas we have about who we are don't hold up very well anymore. And as the many of these more complicated social concepts that we've acquired over our lifetime begin to crumble away, some people find it's quite frightening, disorienting, partly because how they feel, how some people make safety for themselves is they build up a sense of self in relationship to other selves, and that way they can find themselves and know who they are and feel somewhat safe. But if the usual constructs that we have begin to fall away, it can be frightening. I came at one point in my practice, I came up to what to me felt like a precipice, a cliff, and it was really clear that I was playing social games. I was trying to present myself to people as that I was a certain kind of person. So I was playing games, social games, conversation games, to try to, you know, explain to them or convince them who I was. They probably could see me who I was better than I could, but, you know, I was, you know, trying to build up a sense of self and have a self and idea of who I was. And I could see that I was doing it. It became clear that I should let it go. It wasn't serving me. But it was like standing on the edge of a cliff and being asked to take a step over the edge. I was afraid to do it. It took actually quite a while before I was able to take that step and step away from this shell, this weight that I've been carrying. It was no longer needed. So the experience of dropping away of these kind of maybe more superficial ideas of selves or unnecessary ideas of self or complicated fantasies or delusions of self that people do have, it's a lot easier to do if you land someplace, if you have something to replace it with. And if you have this, you know, sense of confidence, uprightness, you take your seat, you take your bodhimanda, here I am, and you can sit here with upright and clear and strong. You can shed all kinds of selves, all kinds of social construct, all kinds of things. You don't need it because you can sit here, breathe easily and well and clearly and know oneself, know what's going on inside, know one's desires, know feelings, emotions, motivations. Just, you know, there's a confidence that holds letting go of all these constructs that we no longer need. So part of this practice then is to cultivate the opposite of not-self, and I'm calling it confidence here. And how do we do that? I think that one of the ways not to do it is to spend a lot of time looking for it. You know, I'm searching, I go into my mind, I go into my heart, I'm just searching for it, it must be in there, I have to find where my confidence is. I don't know if maybe that can work, but I think confidence is cultivated by doing things. And you can start with small things. There was a time, I told you, I admitted, you know, the opening of the retreat, right, that I chickened out on my first retreat. I didn't have the confidence now going on retreat, I've done this long enough, I have confidence. Give me a retreat and I'll show up. And it's a confidence that's been acquired from doing retreats. And over time, people get develop confidence on retreat, doing it again and again, and all the different challenges that come up. The first time it seems too much, seems like we don't have confidence for it. And then over time, we have more confidence. So I still have challenges, I still have physical pain. I remember when I was completely crushed by my, psychologically crushed, emotionally crushed by my pain, and so discouraged by it. And I can have the same level of pain now that I had when I was 20 or 21. And I have confidence that I can be with it. I'm not pushed around by it. I'm not troubled by it. I'm not worried or afraid by it. I just, you know, I can be with it. And it, you know, it's okay. That confidence has been acquired by practicing with it over time. So confidence is partly developed, I think very much developed by doing. And but you don't want to do, you know, you don't want to scale Mount Whitney here in California, the highest mountain in California, before you've, you know, before, if you've never, you know, climbed the hill behind your house. You know, you want to kind of, you know, develop slowly and take little steps. And once you're confident you climb that little hill, then you go find a little taller hill and a taller one and taller one. And you develop not only skill, but you develop the strengths needed to eventually you can climb to top of Mount Whitney. So, you know, we in practice here, we have to do the practice and have, it's usually best I think to have modest ambitions. Let me see if I can manage to sit, maybe it's not modest enough for us sometimes for someone who's new, but let me try sitting for 40 minutes, for half an hour sittings without moving. Or let me try see if I can manage to be with three breaths. By the end of the sitting, I hope to be able to follow three consecutive breaths. There was a time for me that that was an accomplishment. Wow, Gil, you did it! Three breaths! So, you know, I have to start somewhere. And then you can do four, and five, up to 10. And I kind of stopped at 10. Sometimes I go beyond that, but that's just an accident. Or, you know, I'm just settled in and just, you know, going along. But I used to count my breath a lot. That's what they taught in Zen. So sometimes they counted beyond 10, but you weren't supposed to count beyond 10. So as soon as I caught myself, you're supposed to just go back to one. You weren't, so. So anyway, so slowly I developed confidence that I could be with my breathing. I've had all kinds of emotional storms and sitting here and meditating. And to when they arise, to think of them not just as in the ordinary way, maybe, whatever that is, of being with an emotional storm, but to consider, oh, now is my chance to develop some confidence with this. And again, you should be modest with it, modest with the, what you're trying to accomplish. But maybe modest would be, let me just see, I'm not, if I can not collapse physically. I remember once the most dramatic moment that I collapsed in all my meditation career. You can imagine that I was sitting in a location kind of like this. The Green Gulch Zendo, some of you know, but kind of like this, and the door was over there, and they weren't going to ring the bell to end the sitting until the abbot returned, and he didn't come back. He didn't come back, and as Zen students, you're not supposed to move, so it was excruciatingly painful, and it was late in the evening, and we had to wait, and wait, and wait, and I was, you know, And finally, I just collapsed, you know, in the most unbecoming Zen way. I mean, physically, just kind of, you know, guess who walks through the door at that moment? That moment, the abbot walked through, and here I be, he's coming directly in front of me, right? I was just so. So what's the? I don't know what to do. I went back to my room and sobbed. But you know, just be able to stay with it, stay upright in the middle of it. Not try to fix it or to be complicated with it or analyze it, or just maybe that's enough to have confidence. I can sit through this. I've heard of people who have addiction issues that they have a practice sometimes called riding the wave. And that is that the strong desire for alcohol might come up. And these strong desires, and other desires too, can come with a lot of authority, with a lot of insistence. But the riding out the wave is to just stay in your seat, don't move. Simply don't do just that. Sooner or later, the wave will crest, and you'll find yourself on the backside of it, and the desire will have abated. And the people I've known who've done this practice develop a lot of confidence. Wow, I can stay in my seat and not move, and then it'll pass. So, you know, it's all kinds of, so it's just to stay and be present. So one of the things that we're cultivating here, whether you know it or not, is confidence. If you're too ambitious about it, or if you make that the centerpiece of what you're doing, that might not work so well either. But it's good to keep in mind that as you do this practice, there's all kinds of benefits that are coming in, all kinds of things that are being developed, coming in kind of through the back door. And one of them is to be able to inhabit oneself more fully, in order to be in one's body, in a embodied, inhabited, confident way. And so how would you sit if that's the way what you're cultivating? How would you stay present? Can you maybe make it simpler what you're doing when you're being mindful? If all you're trying to do is to stay present as opposed to fix something or adjust something or change something, so you can develop confidence in your ability to be present. Because as we go along in practice, and the practice goes deeper and deeper, there comes times where the very best thing you can do is not do. The very best thing you can do is just be present and trust what's happening. Allow what's happening to move through you. If you have confidence in your ability to stay present, then it's easier to have some of these things arise and come through. Otherwise, it can seem like the storms are too difficult or overwhelming, and maybe you'll collapse just when Matthew's walking in through the door. So two things that I want to repeat as emphasis of the points of the talk. One is you're important. You're an autonomous person of value. And certainly I hope that us teachers and all of us for each other can respect the autonomy and value and dignity and of each individual person. And that's part of the context with which we're doing this practice. And if there are differences, that's where we meet. And that maybe there's some way that's your way that you can make room in this practice to allow for the growth of confidence, growth of these forms of inner strength that Joy Monet talks about. So in a psychological way, in the way psychotherapists talk, you develop a stronger sense of self. And then Joy Monet says, otherwise, there's nothing to change and nothing to go beyond. And so in a few days, we'll talk about this not-self thing. And as when that comes up in part of the talks, you'll have this hopefully at least in principle as a foundation that really supports this. We're not losing that confidence in exploring not-self. Maybe what we're doing is we're actually enhancing it, because the kind of self that's a problem is that which limits us, and that limitation falls away, and what's left is comes forth in this strength and confident way. And then finally, I'll say, partly because of the context of being a retreat like this, I don't know what kind of thoughts this talk has generated for you, but if this idea of confidence seems valuable for you, maybe don't think about it too much. Little bits, okay. But rather, see if this if you have a capacity for inner silence, allowing something inside to become still. That in that inner silence or inner stillness, maybe you can feel, or you can give birth to, an energy or to a way of being, which has a calm, peaceful confidence. Maybe you can tune into it. And as you do, maybe that can support you to be with your breathing, do your walking meditation, help you be mindful in a clearer way, because the whole mindfulness is part of a confident, peaceful, inner stillness. So let's sit for a minute or two.